So this is a sound from the rally yesterday, the Pershing Square rally, and in the studio, Karen Kroner, my bits of support provider. Hey.
Want to come close?
So, Karen, you are exactly on time, and that just says a lot. So you're a pizza provider. How's that?
It's my second year of doing it, and last year I had a teacher that actually worked at the same school as myself, so that was really kind of special. We got to do a lot of co-planning and even co-teaching in the same room. And I know you could look at the process as kind of cumbersome and just another kind of thing that new teachers have to jump through, but I've seen it as a really positive experience with sharing and, yeah, trading ideas.
Because a lot of people hate pizza.
I know.
But, I mean, I have always hated pizza.
I don't think you're alone. I mean, I think it's pretty widespread. I think to put it on a new teacher, I mean, I can think back. I didn't have to go through BITSA. It wasn't around when I was a new teacher. And I just remember feeling really overwhelmed when I first started and then having to go to school at the same time. If I would have had BITSA, I would have probably not been very happy with it either. It's a lot to put on new teachers.
Yeah, it's like you have great papers to grade, you have lesson planning to do, and then you've got more stuff to do, and it doesn't seem to really, in most cases, make your job any easier.
Yeah, and I don't know even if at the beginning, if I would have appreciated the, when I started teaching, I don't know if I would have appreciated the whole kind of reflective nature, like reflecting on teaching at that point in my career. Like I just, like I said, you're in survival mode when you first start, and teaching didn't become fluid and smooth for me. I mean, we've talked about this until, I don't know, year 10? And I'd like to think I'm a fairly, you know, it's not like I'm slow or anything. It's just that's really how long it took to, yeah, get a whole sort of rhythm going. I don't know, maybe bits of year 10?
Well, but you said, like, by year 3 you were having fun, at least. I mean,
oh, I had fun year 1. We had a lot of fun. I just don't know how great of a teacher I was to all the students in the room, but we had fun.
So you're now a national board certified. Does that mean that you're a good teacher now? What does that mean when you're national board certified? I'm impressed with it, actually, so I'm not trying to say.
I had to do it. Well, first of all, I did it more for financial reasons, because once you max out on the salary table, there's really nowhere to go. And I support 2 children, a household, you know, on my income. And so I was looking for what can I do to actually bring in some more cash. I wasn't doing it for, like, higher reasons at the time. And to become National Board Certified, there's really, like, 4 different areas. Where you sort of write up a pretty lengthy paper, you tape yourself in the classroom. And again, it's a very reflective process, like reflecting on your teaching. And there's a test that you have to take at a testing center that's kind of very stressful. But I was ready for it at that point. I did it when I had been teaching for 9 years, 10 years, something like that. And so for me, it was really positive. It was the right time to do it. It really kind of made me think about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And I was actually glad to go through it. I don't know that it makes me a better teacher, but it forced me to reflect. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't saying that it would make you a better teacher. I was just trying to say, like, does that really mean something when somebody's a National Board Certified teacher? But I think it does. And my BITSA experience is improving. It really is, because you're giving me actual stuff. I don't think it has to do with BITSA so much, though, as the fact that, like, we're doing it in a coffee shop that's a cool coffee shop, and you're giving me, like, lesson plans. And it's like, you know, most of the time when you're being support provided, they don't actually give you stuff. They ask you to sort of justify yourself.
Yeah, and I guess that's the way, I mean, what it should be to me in my mind is that, yeah, a more experienced teacher comes with the bag of tricks and shares the bag of tricks. I mean,
right.
As teachers, I think sharing, some are good at it at some schools, some teachers are good at it, and then others, I don't know, it's kind of funny, they really don't want to share. But to me, the more we share, the more it benefits the children. And every good idea I have, I took from somewhere else. I either read it in a book or I saw another teacher do it. And the more we can just get those great ideas out there, it's for the kids, you know, the better it is for the kids.
Yeah, it's like Harry Wong says, you got to steal your as much as you can from other teachers.
That's the way it works, yeah.
And so tell me about your read-alouds.
Well, I've been reading aloud. I started my first year teaching, and back then it really, I can remember, I had a rocking chair in the room. I was teaching fourth grade. We would do it after we came in from lunch, and there was no structure really at all. And I have to say, back then, I didn't have any mandated curriculum, which is kind of crazy to think about. 12 years ago, no mandated curriculum. So I had a little bit more liberty with what I was doing with my time. So we would come in from lunch, and we would actually turn off the lights, and I had a little lamp in the room, and we would turn on the lamp, and everyone would sit around, and the boys would be laying under the tables, and girls would be braiding my hair. This is fourth grade. And the girls would be
this
braiding.
This was before, this is why you were still having just fun.
Yeah, this was the just fun years, yeah. And girls would be braiding my hair. Remember Denisha? Denisha would braid my hair, and it was just this really, like, soothing, I don't know, it felt like grandma, even though I wasn't that old at the time, but like grandma with all of the grandchildren at her feet. And it was just like magical. It was magical. The kids, I actually looped with them. I went from fourth grade to fifth grade with that class. And their love of books surpassed like anything that I saw in classes later. I mean, it was about fun. It was about the stories. We did things like Walk Two Moons. I can remember reading that aloud. Chickabiddy, the grandparents are just hilarious. And it was magical. Read aloud was magical. There was no structure. I didn't tie anything to it. It was just about the love of reading at that point in time.
So no standards?
No standards. No. Wow. I was just going to read, because first of all, when you teach fourth grade and you're their teacher all day long, you're the PE teacher, you don't get a break. There's no prep period. There's no nothing. Elementary school teachers, hats off to those guys. And they would come in from lunch, and they're already tired, and they're wound up from being out on the yard, and you needed to do something to just kind of soothe everyone before you tried to teach some more after lunch. And so that was really my goal at that point. And sharing books, which I've always, you know, that's part of why I teach, because I love reading, and I want to share that with students. So, no, it was really just about loving books at that point.
And you will actually read the same books they read.
Oh, yes. Ever since I started teaching, I don't read adult books anymore, and I sort of fear what that's doing to my brain. I think I'm regressing, so on the outside, I'm wrinkling, and on the inside, I don't know, I think I'm 12. Because, yeah, I just read adolescent literature.
You had an effect on my class when you observed the other day. They were asking me if you were coming back, and the weird thing is the ones that you picked out as being, like, throwing things on the floor, and, like, that the girl who you pointed out at the end as throwing things on the floor and not doing her work, she wanted to know if when you were coming back, and I said, you want her to come back? And she said, and she just looked at me very seriously and nodded her head.
That's really interesting. I wonder what that is kind of saying, you know, interesting.
She's wants to be discovered, I think.
Yeah, uh-huh. And maybe some kind of, I don't know, this underlying, the teenagers are funny, like they don't outwardly want any kind of structure, but I think on the inside they do.
Okay.
Like the cleanliness, yeah, the thing. I don't know, it's funny.
Well, we always say they're crying for help.
Yeah.
And
it's another, I didn't have to do anything in the room that day. I just get to sit. So that's really different. And when I've been in co-teaching situations, just it's really a luxury to have another adult in the room.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a luxury because, yeah, automatically students are going to end up with more attention, automatically. Co-teaching is awesome.
And I had two adults in the room that day. One was a parent.
Yeah.
And you talked to her.
Yeah.
And she's her child is a handful for her. That's why she was there, of course. So,
Really interesting. That's the first time I've been in a single gender classroom situation.
Yeah,
I found it really interesting.
Well, yeah, did you notice the anything girlish about it?
Well, I'm a girl, or I was a girl. Now I'm an old mujer, but I used to be a girl. I thought it was really interesting. Just the feeling in the room. I find it fascinating. I think it's really an interesting experiment. And I was trying to ask some of the girls if they enjoyed it, and pretty much they all seem to agree they really like having the single gender.
That is so weird because they told me they hated it. So what's going on?
They told me they liked it. Maybe we talked to different girls. I don't know. They told me they liked it.
So do you think that, like, Michelle Rhee, that education reformer, and Waiting for Superman, she says that you're basically, you know, the good teachers are just a certain type of people. And do you believe that?
No, I don't think I do, because, I mean, I've been teaching for 12 years, and I've been at a few different schools. I'm someone who's moved around every couple years. And so I've come across many, many teachers, and I don't really see kind of one sort of good teacher type. I see a lot of really dedicated, interesting human beings who bring their love of what they're into the classroom. And so, they come from all different sort of backgrounds. And that's why I think there should be more of an opening, too, for people that are mid-career, like people that change careers and then bring that love into the room of what they've done in the past. Because I've seen some really interesting things happening, whether it's, you know, journalism, someone who used to be a newspaper writer, whether it was an engineer. I've seen a lot of, people from different backgrounds and then bring that into the classroom.
Well, I just had an idea. What if, I keep hearing this, you know, if you got to bring what you love into the classroom. And, but then there's all the stuff that you don't love that you have to do. And I'm wondering if you could get a whole bunch of different people who each love a different part of the thing, that the curriculum, and you could just rotate them around so that each person could still be doing what they love.
I don't know. There's many things that I philosophically get very frustrated with being forced to do, especially when I feel like I'm fairly well educated. I've gotten a master's degree in education, and I've, you know, and then you're told what to do, and when you know it's not quite the right thing. Anyway, I mean, I could go on and on, but it's like I even explain it with the kids because the kids seem to know. Like, when you're forced to read something out of an anthology, I mean, that even happened the day you were reading the story in your room, you know, teacher, this story is boring, right? And that happens all the time. And so the way I try and explain it to the kids is, it's not the Miss Kroner school. This is, you know, LA Unified, and even I'm being told what to do, and I call it the spinach. Like, just like you got to eat your spinach at home. It's like we got to do a certain amount of spinach, and then we get to have dessert, and the dessert is the stuff that I love that I bring to the room. I wish it could be all dessert, but it doesn't work.
We don't always get dessert in my class. Not every day. We're lucky to get it a few times a week.
And that's where, you know, I would do free choice reading, which is, it would be the first 15 minutes of class where the kids are individually reading a book they choose, and it's structured, and I know exactly what they're reading. And then the read aloud, and then the way I would teach writing was different from how I was supposed to. And those things, that came every day, and that's where I got my energy into the room so that I could make it through the parts that, you know, I didn't philosophically agree with.
So you told me about your mentor and how she had a garage. And it's such a cinematic moment. You went to where she teaches at a college, and she opened up a whole sliding, what do you call those, garage door.
She was my mentor out at Pacific Oaks, where I got my teaching credential and my master's degree in Pacific Oaks, because it's an amazing place with incredible teachers, anti-bias education, social justice foundation. And so Shauna Friesen was one of my teachers there. She became my mentor teacher. She's now at Teachers College at Columbia in New York with a fantasy job. You know, Lucy Calkins, just amazing. She travels around the world looking at classrooms. But back then, she would teach at a Pasadena public school. She was teaching third grade, and then she taught as adjunct faculty at Pacific Oaks on the side. And so I had asked her if she had, I forget, it was some kind of math resource that I was looking for. And she said, okay, meet me over at Pacific Oaks, and I'll show you what I've got. And so we go out behind the college, and there's literally a garage, and she opens up the door, and it's filled. And at first I thought it belonged to the college, and then I found out that was her own personal storage space. So she'd been teaching about how long I have now, 12 years at that point. And as a new teacher, to see that garage was kind of overwhelming, because you started to have this sense of like what it takes to be a really good teacher, and the own your own personal investment. I mean, she bought all that stuff and cataloged it and uses it. I mean, it's just, wow, teaching is really amazing when you think about it, what we do.
Do you think it's possible that I might be too lazy to be a really good teacher? Are there really good lazy teachers?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I don't know that I've met every great teacher, you know?
I mean, lazy is a... it's a label, but
I don't know. To me, it takes it takes so much energy just to grade all their papers in a timely. When you're teaching English,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm grading these papers, and I'm thinking, well, they have computer programs that grade essays, and that's great. But you end up really not knowing their writing at all. But then there's 150 of them, and how much could you really know their writing anyway? I mean.
Well, but if you teach it through a workshop, we've talked about this a little, teaching writing through a writer's workshop model, I think is really the only way to do it without pulling your hair out. So that means that kids are writing during a specific like writing time in the classroom, and you're conferencing individually with students. I mean, that's the only way that the student's going to get individualized feedback, which I think is the only way that their writing's going to improve, and that you have a chance in class to sit down with the student and review their writing. So by the time you go to grade it, you've seen that paper three or four times, if not more. You're very familiar with it, and it makes it much easier to grade quickly.
And so the writing workshop goes like, you give them a model, you model it?
You model, it's a heavily based on modeling. So first, you're always doing whatever you expect the students to do. So if we're doing memoir, I actually write memoir. I go through the steps with them. I act like a child. I mean, clearly I could write faster and easier, but I'm trying to make the kinds of mistakes or struggle with the kinds of things that I see the students struggling with on purpose so that you can work through it with them in the room. So a lot of modeling, mini lessons, and then on either craft or just the procedure of writing workshop itself. And then students have a certain amount of time, 20 minutes maybe, to actually write where you're conferencing. And the last year at Irving, last year I had a laptop cart so that every student had a laptop, and they were actually doing the drafting as well on the computer, which made it really, really fascinating. A lot more fun for the students, a lot easier for me to read their work, because sometimes even their writing is hard to decipher. It helps with spelling because they automatically see when they're making mistakes. I mean, so I was really a big fan of using the laptop cart every single day with Writer's Workshop.
So, and then they would print it out?
When it was published, So they would come, when they would come and conference with me, I'd be sitting at the back. I would have numbers, just like when you're at the grocery store and you take a number. And they would take numbers when they needed to meet with me, and I would call, okay, number two, number two, number three. And I was always meeting with two students at a time, and they would come to where I was sitting with their laptop. And we looked at it online. They would make their revisions, and then when we felt like they would also do peer revising, so not just with me, but they had to sit with a peer. And when they felt like it was ready, it was, you know, ready to be published, then, yeah, they print in the room. Yeah.
So how do you read it in its electronic form? You go.
Yeah, I was reading it in the electronic form. So as I was sitting at the table with the student, they would have the laptop was between us, and we were reading it on the computer screen. Saved a lot of paper.
And you got to everybody with the conference.
Yeah,
But not on the same day.
Not in the same day. I would try to meet with all of the students a week and a half. A week's kind of pushing it. 5 days is really hard to meet with. Let's say you have 36. That's really pushing it. So a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks at the most. Mm-hmm. Trying to meet with everyone, yes.
That's a big problem that I have, and I think a lot of beginning teachers have, is pacing. You know you're supposed to do something, but you have no idea how long it's going to take. And then often, you know, your ideas about how long it's going to take, when they start conflicting with the reality, then things get messy.
Yeah, and even as a 12-year teacher, I'm continually amazed how – I think I started off when I first started teaching zooming through everything. And then the lesson I've learned is like to slow down, to model every step. And yeah, even now after 12 years, things take much longer in the classroom to do well than I ever could have guessed. Yeah. Slowing down.
So can you have a life outside? Teaching,
I have a tiny life outside.
Well, but you're doing triathlons and have two kids, and I wouldn't call that.
Yeah, tiny. But I only do one triathlon in September, so it comes after the summer break. And I do a century ride in November. But both of those things start gearing up over the summer, so where you do have time to put in the training hours. And I have two kids, yeah, but my husband stays home with the baby, so that's a huge help. I wouldn't be able to do it without all of his help. So I have a tiny life. You are able to, after a certain number of years, again, probably around year 10, things do get more manageable, and the more you have routine and the more you do things like writer's workshop, like there's a way to do things that are more efficient so that you are able to have more of a life outside of the room. It is possible.
You know, for some reason I assumed you were a single mom. I think everybody's single, and I think everybody's divorced.
Well, I am. I'm divorced and remarried.
Because we talked about you being divorced, and but I didn't know you were remarried yet. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I don't wear a ring. I know, it's confusing. Yeah.
Well, that's good. What does he do?
Well, right now we have a 2-year-old, so his primary thing is taking care of the 2-year-old. And uh-huh. He shuttles the 14-year-old back and forth to school and does all that, and dentist appointments, so that I'm kind of more freed up to just do work. Yeah.
Do you think do you give him credit for like his work? Do you feel that's actually work?
I do. I maybe don't tell him that the way I should all the time, but deep down, yeah, I know what he's doing is, well, we made the decision together that we didn't want to put the 2-year-old in any kind of daycare, that we wanted him at home. So yeah, it was a decision we made. Financially, it's been really, really tough. But in the long run, it's the right thing. We think it's the right thing to do.
So you had a career before teaching.
Yeah, I was an accountant, and first I worked for one of the big accounting firms at the time, Deloitte. And that was in Phoenix, Arizona. And then I got recruited to work for Disney out here, which is how I ended up in California. And I worked an internal audit for Disney and then the International Home Video Group. And I had a really very amazing time traveling around the world. I went to many different countries on behalf of Disney. And as a young person in their 20s, it was really an incredible time.
We're talking to Karen Kroner, and you work at City of Angels.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting school, right?
It's very different. I didn't even know it existed before. I'd never heard of it. It's the only independent study program in LA Unified. And so I teach high school, and I have students who don't fit into the regular high school model for a bunch of different reasons. Some just haven't been successful. Some are older, don't have enough credits, and they're even being told by the high school that they were at that it's time to go. You're too old and not enough credits, which is kind of sad and a separate sad story. Then I have girls who are teenage moms, and they don't have child care, and it would be really difficult to finish school in another way. I have one student who's very ill, in and out of the hospital, so this program allows her to do what she needs to do with the doctor and then still get her work done. So, yeah, interesting place.
And the way it works is they meet with you. There's no class. They meet with you alone.
Yeah, except some City of Angels teachers do a small group setting, which I think is what we're going to be moving to next year. I have one person who's my partner, Hinda Joy Lowry. And next year she's going to be doing math and science, and I'm going to be doing English and history, and we're going to split the electives, and then we are going to move to a small group setting. Yeah. But it's not the same as a classroom with 36. No, it's different.
You meet with, like, you meet with them for an hour each?
Right now, this year, yeah, we're meeting with them for an hour each individually, and you teach all subjects. So I have 9th through 11th grade, and wide a range of either English 9A, 9B, 10A, 10B, contemporary composition, algebra, then math, algebra 1A, 1B. I had an algebra 2 student, geometry, math lab, which is basically the elective to get them prepared for algebra, history, world history, U.S. history.
How many preps is that?
It's insane. When I first started.
How is that even possible?
Well, there are instructional guides that they give you for each class.
Oh, instructional guides.
But it's,
my
you know.
Favorite.
Yeah, but if you're not happy with what's there, like if it doesn't match what you see the kids need, then you're constantly trying to rework the instructional guide at the same time and getting to know the curriculum. So there's a huge learning curve, definitely. It's different, really different.
Is this a coveted job that you have?
I've heard that, I think many teachers, because there's you don't deal with the classroom management issues that you would in a normal classroom, I think a lot of teachers have wanted to go to City of Angels in the past, yeah.
I think even my administrator was trying to, when she told me that the LAUSD might not be for me, that and now I should go to a private school or City of Angels, she said. Okay, I can't hack it in LAUSD, I'll go to something even harder.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had 16 teachers RIF, though. So we're a definitely high RIF area. A lot of the teachers at City of Angels are very high seniority. It's a spot where some people go and then they stay. They don't leave. So we have very high seniority staff. But
well,
we
if
lost
it's so
16.
High seniority, how'd you lose 16?
Well, there's certain schools like Lathy, whatever, from the lawsuit that can't lose any teachers.
Right.
So it's like it had to be distributed kind of evenly. I think all schools got hit kind of hard.
Yeah, but I thought it wasn't going deeper
and
than 4 years.
Oh, no. We have a couple teachers with eight years.
Now that is, so eight.
Eight. Well, there's a few with 8 years experience.
And then I want to get to, I have footage from the rally yesterday where people were angry.
I was there. Maybe
I was
I'm there.
Oh, awesome. I mean, people were angry, and there was a lot of good feeling there too, though. And I don't know. It's hard to imagine that many people, and those kinds of middle class and working class people, could lose in this country. But you can't be too sure, of course, that in the long run. Who knows what direction.
What frustrates me the most is like being, I don't know, in the media you kind of get the feeling that they're trying to tell you that there is no money, when clearly that's not what's going on. There is money. There's money for war. There's money for prisons. You know, it's like, so there's money. The question is, how is the money being allocated? And that's the really frustrating part to me, that education isn't ranking higher on that allocation.
I want to talk about somebody I know at Garfield was telling me that she has 23 first year teachers teaching at Garfield. So, and the district promised, only said we can only guarantee you a year, and now they're getting riffed, I think. But, and how is it possible to have 23 first year teachers when they had just riffed a bunch of senior teachers the year before who should have gotten any new jobs that were available, right? And she says that she thinks it's because they did it on purpose, and they just wanted to get those teachers out.
Huh. It wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't be surprised.
Can I play a little bit of the rally here? This
yeah.
is when I'm just walking through the rally, and this is what I heard. Wait, that's when they introduced Tom Morello. Were you there then, or that was late in the rally?
No, I made it to Pershing Square, and I had the 2-year-old with me, and he was so good. Dying because they don't have march.
Dying because they back the win.
You did what he?
We didn't stay long at Pershing Square.
2-year-old, and that doesn't have a lot of stamina.
No,
for
he was good for the actual marching part, though. Yeah, we left.
What does he talk?
Oh yeah, he's very verbal.
Does he have funny words that he says?
That's kind of cleared up already. He's pretty succinct with his verbiage now.
Okay. Okay, so here's when I walked in.
Table! Back to the ridge! The mud hut there! Back to the ridge! Everybody has a right to an education! Education should be free through college!
Thank you.
was just passing different different little sub things. Something like this. Next. So Tom Morello was there, and a lot of different people. It's one guy.
Teamsters were huge. Teamsters
yeah.
were out in force.
Which is weird, you know. I mean, it's weird that like Teamsters and teachers in the, are in the same. The same breath. And actors and directors and writers also have unions.
Yeah. And custodians are in the airport.
Anyway, it was a huge rally, right?
I've been to several downtown. It was a fairly decent size. Yeah, the line was long. I waited at the beginning to UTLA was at the end, and so I watched the whole procession go by. It was pretty large.
Well, I'll play some more later. But anyway, you get the idea. You were there.
I was there.
I talked to two teachers, friends of mine from Santee, who went out to another Santee teacher's birthday party last night. And these are two great teachers. One of them designed the pilot school that she's at right now, hired the principal, and she's getting riffed. And the other one's just a really good teacher doing all this amazing work with different groups that she works with, and Students Run LA and Association of RASA Educators.
Well, and there were amazing banners there yesterday from different schools where parents had come out to support the teachers that had been riffed, and the banners showed the faces of the teachers on it, and it was just like this time, this cut is really, it's going deep. It's really very sad for the future. And then with the latest round of the public school choice, I mean, we've also just lost a number of schools to charter schools, which again is going to cut down the number of spots for in the regular public school system. It's moving to charter.
So can you give me your take on charters?
Well, I worked for a charter school for 4 years. It was called LA Leadership Academy. It was a wonderful experience. Small school, only a little over 200 students. So you knew all the kids, you knew the families. We had really tight discipline controls, so if a student didn't do their homework, man, you were all over them. The kids hated it because they couldn't get away with anything, but it's just like you knew everything about the kid, about the family, how to help them. It felt like the school felt like a family, very supportive, really enjoyed working there. You had more creative control over your curriculum. You could do the things that you needed to do to help the students in your own way.
Well, that doesn't sound bad. It sounds
no. It was
good.
All it was all good. It was all great. And then the fifth year the school had been open, they wanted to switch to merit pay. That was one change they were making. They threatened to take away health care benefits for dependents, which for me was a direct hit. Like I don't think I could even survive with having that change made. And they were getting rid of the Spanish program at the school, which I was always kind of cored with the Spanish teachers. They were either in a Spanish class or with me in a English as a second language class. And so it was really, we felt the whole bilingual nature of the school was of utmost importance for the students. And so to see the Spanish be cut was another very painful thing, and not, we thought we had more control over kind of how the school was working, and we realized we really didn't. And then when you see the losing the healthcare benefits and changing the pay structure, it really makes you very nervous, and then you realize, yeah, we don't have a union backing us up. We don't have a way to fight back for these changes, and I left.
Is that the way a charter has to be, or is that, I mean, because that's a conversation we're having in, well, a lot of people are having, is are charters necessarily like that? Or can they be, can a bunch of teachers who are really fed up with the district start a charter and have it be like just a teacher controlled school.
Well, I think, like I said, the school itself was doing really wonderful things for the students that were there. It was a great place for those 200 students. The thing about charter schools you have to remember is that they take outside funding to exist. They don't run on ADA money alone. So there has to be outside money coming in to support the school. It's a slide to privatization of the schooling. It's not public. It takes private funds to run. And so that's a really slippery slope. Having one charter school here, one charter school there, that's one thing. But then having more charter, where is all the outside funding going to come from? Is it going to create really more dichotomy of the have and have nots? So who's going to be able to bring in the most funding to keep the school going and to get all the things that they want to have at the school? I don't know. I really don't know.
So they're always bad.
No, I don't know.
Well,
would I want to work at one again?
Not that it's always bad, but
no, not right now. It was so disturbing. Again, I'm the only one working in the house, and I need to know my income is stable. I have the healthcare benefits. Those things mean a lot to me.
We have somebody on the phone. Can you mind if I bring him on the phone?
Sure.
This is Mark Musgrath. From Santee. How you doing, Mark?
Good.
You didn't hear the conversation, but we're talking about charter schools. Necessary evil or just evil? No. What do you think? We're saying that they require money always, outside money, private money, right? And so, therefore, that leads to not having control, I think, is what we're trying to say. No. Leads to privatization.
Yeah, well, charter schools are, private, quasi-private. And they do take public money, though, and that is kind of the concern. Of course, the big thing is that they claim they're getting better results, but the data I don't think really show that. Diane Ravitch points out that only about 17% of them actually do better than a similarly situated public school, so roughly, over 80% are doing the same or worse. So I don't know that that's really an answer, although you're seeing a lot of corruption. We just had some charters here revoked because they were cheating on the test scores. And others that have, they pay their principals, huge amounts of money. There's no financial transparency. It's a problem.
Hey, Mark, you're a big, you have a bunch of stuff on Facebook. I saw one about the American Indian Public Charter School. I'd like to play that video and see what Karen has to say about it.
Okay.
Okay, Karen?
Tuck in your shirt, sit up straight, and hit the books or else. That is the law of the land. At a low-income public school in Oakland, it's a controversial attitude toward education. But as NBC Bay Area's Vicki Nguyen reports, it's an attitude that's won top honors.
The globe. We are always working for academic and social excellence.
It's back to school at American Indian Public Charter School in Oakland.
We are a family at AIPCS.
And students are receiving their marching orders.
If a staff member catches you walking down the hallway and your shirt is untucked, you're going to get a detention. If you're not going to do your homework, you're going to get a detention. If you're going to be disrespectful to your teacher or, a visitor at the school, you will get detention.
In fact, almost every kid at this school gets detention.
Oh, yes, I did. In the seventh grade, I got a life.
There's no such thing as an excused absence, not for a doctor's appointment, a family emergency, or an illness.
Is he sick to the point where he can't get out of bed? Because if he can, I would suggest that he or she comes to school.
A missed class must be made up at Saturday school. 5 missed classes, and you're automatically held back.
We have a zero tolerance. We don't tolerate anything. We don't tolerate excuses.
It's a back-to-basics attitude. You won't find anything fancy here. Just books, a whiteboard, and desks that are half a century old.
That's all you need. Pencil, paper, books, and a great teacher.
Teachers are hired based on math skills and a strict upbringing. To quote the school website, multicultural specialists, ultra-liberal zealots, and college-tainted oppression liberators need not apply. It's all about academics and discipline.
Okay, so Karen is having a visceral reaction.
AIPCS is one of the highest performing schools in the state. Its academic performance index is 967 out of 1,000. The state average is 750. And for low-income students, it's about 650.
So we don't do technology. We don't do any creative things. We just focus on the academics.
Despite the controversial military-like approach, parents think it's a breath of fresh air.
I came in with those same myths and phobias and negativity. And when I started working, it was a entirely different picture.
The bar of academics is set really high, and the bar of discipline is set really high.
The discipline's so strict, students are often degraded in front of their peers. They're forced to clean toilets as punishment. And a teacher once shaved a kid's head because he was acting out. Despite these strict rules, kids here say they like it.
Because it definitely disciplines the kids to have, like, to stay off the streets and to try to live a life to the fullest.
And if they can't hack it, as far as the school is concerned, the kids can leave.
Yes, we do have kids who transfer out because it's too much homework, or they refuse and they're lazy and they go home and they cry to their parents.
Tough love in a tough town, pushing kids in a new direction. Vicki Nguyen, NBC Bay Area News.
In June, American Indian Charter School graduated the first class. 100% of the students are going on to a four-year college, including MIT and Cornell. Heated up over health care.
Well.
Wow.
So, now, Karen is she's turning red. She was turning red a little bit. And I know that Mark, you're aware that you know, liberal tainted, what is it? Oppressor resistors? College tainted liberal oppression resistors need not apply. You know, it's like a certain, are you still there, Mark?
Yeah, I'm here.
Some people are just so fed up with the classroom management problems, I think, that they are looking at this as a solution. And other people are saying that this is like prison, right?
I got lots of responses to that post.
Karen.
I'm watching that, and I think it's so unfortunate. I think, like you're saying, there are a lot of classroom management issues in a regular public school where you have too many kids stuffed into a room and mandated curriculum that is not the most the best match for the students in front of you. There's a lot of different issues, sure. And then social promotion, where we just promote kids through even though we know they don't have the skills for the next grade. Gosh, there's so many things, but is this the answer? I think watching this, this is really scary if people latch onto it and think that this is an actual positive direction that we should be moving.
Well, also, this is a charter school. I mean, that's the way it ties into the conversation. And this could never happen in a public school. And what do you have to say, Mark?
Well, I posted that to contrast that, you know, basically charters can have the independence to make these kind of pedagogical decisions. And my point simply was, you know, let's free the public schools from, you know, some of these same restrictions, and they can come up with innovative ways of addressing the academic issues, and as well as others that our students face. But, you know, it's almost like the public schools are kind of hamstrung by a number of regulations, ed code, federal mandates, etc., which, you know, essentially prevent them from really doing anything but what they've always done, which is just kind of like, okay, here it is, here's our curriculum, let's try this. Wow, Johnny is really acting like a poor student. He's really, disrespectful. He's doing some criminal acts, and we can't do anything to him. And it's disruptive to the whole solution, whole school setting.
And that's one thing, being at the charter school, that's one thing. Another thing that a charter school can do is they get rid of students left and right. If little Jose is doing too many, disrespectful acts at the school, he's gone. And in public school, we don't have that, you know, option of just kicking somebody out the door. They get OT'd, they get transferred. So public schools remain the place where we have to take everyone, and that automatically changes the dynamics.
Right, but that begs the question of should we have to take everyone? Or failing that, why is the system not actually designing schools that will address the needs of students who might exhibit extremely pathological behaviors and address those needs in a much smaller setting,
or what have you.
Because it can't just simply be we take all the kids and therefore, because if you're going to take all the kids with all their problems, of course, plenty of middle class parents are going to be like, well, I don't dare send my child to those schools. That's why there's a demand for charters. My point is there shouldn't be a demand for charters. A public school system should be operated efficiently and effectively to meet the needs of the communities they serve.
Oh, I completely agree with you, but has public school ever really done that? I'm not sure. And I don't know. I mean, the students that I teach in the communities that I serve, I wonder how much, I don't know how much I want to say. How many people listen to this radio program?
Oh, well, you never know.
How much do I want to say?
Don't say anything you don't want to help against you. But now I'm really interested. Look.
Yeah, we'll have to talk offline. But,
Well, I want to hear the thing you can't say. Well,
yeah.
Can you say why it would be dangerous for you to say it? Because
yeah, I just don't know that I want my name attached to my comments officially on, you know.
Don't. But
yeah.
I guess.
But
where are we at?
In a way, that says something that teachers are in fear of making observations, and that's too bad because, you know.
But look at
how
the
whole
system.
How can it ever get better unless we can speak frankly and honestly?
Look at how the whole system is set up. Like, how many times have I opened my LA Times in the morning to find yet another article that's blaming teachers, and for, you know, student failure, the test scores are low. Does the public even understand that we have mandated curriculum that we're supposed to be using? I mean, don't the scores show more about the mandated curriculum than the teachers?
I would agree with you. I think that if they're, you know, well, the public at large has the sense that we just kind of do our thing and we're just not doing it very well, and so therefore we should be fired and let go. But you're right. A lot of it is mandated curriculum. I simply say, well, if you know the answers, then buy the curriculum and I'll read the script. I have no problem with that. If you have a curriculum that's going to guarantee that all these kids will be proficient on their CSTs at the end of the year, I'm open to it. I'll read the script. But it's not as simple as that. We all know that.
Right.
Anyone who's been into a classroom knows that the heterogeneity in the skill levels is such that, some kids, it's easy to get to proficiency. Other kids, it's a lot more work, and it's not going to happen instantaneously.
It goes back to social promotion, where we just keep, you know, we're forced to pass these kids on to the next grade so that they end up in high school without the skills that they need. And then as soon as you're in high school, ninth grade, and you're not getting the credits, you've been set up for failure. You have been.
Yeah. And will that ever end? I mean, because we can't have, you know, double the amount of, or I mean, 1.5 the times the amount of third graders that we have. Is there a solution to that? Or to social promotion? Is there any solution? I guess not.
Yeah, is that for me or?
I don't know. Maybe you can't hear me. Is there a solution to social promotion?
I don't know. You could go back to the old way, which is you just don't simply promote, or you hold people back. But you know, that was where you had 15-year-olds in third grade or something. You know, and that seemed a little bizarre, I think. And so, I'm not sure. you know, what you do, but yeah, it's something that has to be addressed. I mean, you can't have a student in Algebra 1 when they don't know their basic arithmetic. That just doesn't seem to make sense, and yet the system keeps programming because, and it's, and they just tell the teacher, fill in the gaps. Well, you know, when the gap is the size of the Grand Canyon, it's not going to be filled in by a teacher, you know, trying to shovel, you know, dirt into the Grand Canyon. You know, you're filling it in a little bit, but it's, you know, it's the proverbial drop in the ocean when we have this, levels of gaps. So we have to find stuff that's going to, you know, probably you might want to have those students tracked so you can then put them in courses that can, you can build them up. I don't know. But see, some of these things, tracking, not socially promoting, they're, I guess, too politically incorrect for the system to even deal with. And yet, that's part of the charter school magic, in a sense, to the extent that they have any magic. They actually do double up English and double up math courses because they understand, hey, well, the kids have gaps, let's double it up and try to close those gaps as quickly as possible.
But the problem with is that they won't take everybody. And
that's also true, and that's also you know, the magic to their secret, or the secret to their magic, is that yes, they cherry pick, and there's no getting around to that. I just went to the California Association of Bilingual Educators conference and watched a presentation, a workshop called "Closing the Latino Achievement Gap." And it was by two, you know, PhDs, Latino individuals, Chapman, one who sits on the board of a charter school in Santa Ana. And, you know, I asked him, and he said, well, we have open enrollment, you know, we have a lottery. And I'm like, well, okay. You know, he was trying to act like that's like, we'll see, so that's, well, by definition, the parents who are most willing to stand in the line hours ahead of time, maybe in some cases, to get in that lottery, by definition, are more parents that are more deeply concerned about their child's education, and that right there is a sorting process. You know, so you're not getting the parents who
don't. Well, not only that, but those parents might have different resources. Like, there's other kinds of parents where, sorry, they have to be at work at a certain time, and it's really like physically impossible. So there's also resources coming into play.
Yes.
And access to knowledge, even accessing, being able to access, how do I even get my kid into that school? What line do I have to stand in?
Right. I mean, I think all of that plays a role to subtly, perhaps, exclude, you know, and that's the process through which they cherry pick, you know, better students or what have you.
And ESL students are you know, significantly underrepresented in the charter schools as well.
So is the charter school movement inimical to democracy?
Well, I'm concerned about the charter school movement in a way because, you know, part of the whole reason for a public school system is to create common civic engagement, common citizenship. That's been the original purpose of the public schools going all the way back. And I'm concerned that with the wide latitude that some of these charter schools do have, that you're not going to really create that anymore. You know, white parents are going to send their kids to a white charter school, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there have been some instances of charter schools with a strong ethnic dimension, and I'm not sure that is healthy for a democracy personally. I think that promotes a kind of hyper-pluralism that could be inimical, as you say, to democracy.
Yeah, well, and charter schools also tend to favor the younger teachers because they're less expensive. So somebody like me who's already 12 years more expensive, do I even have a place in the charter school movement? I don't even think I do. They want the less expensive teacher. And there's actual things posted out on the internet that says the number of years you've been teaching does not equate to any kind of, like, success, which that was really interesting to read.
Yeah, that's Bill Gates'
Yeah. It, yeah. I could speak volumes just about that. And then there was a show on KPFK. A mom had called in, and she lived, I forget the name of the area in Chicago. And in her, where she lived, in her neighborhood, there was no longer a public school, high school available to her. So here she is trying to place her son in a school, and there's no public school. So that automatically, it's also breaking down community, because your kids can't just walk to school anymore. They're going to have to be shuttled to some charter school. And she was really concerned that, you know, my only options are charters, and I have to go do this lottery system everywhere. There's really a chance. What do I do if my son doesn't get into any of these lottery options? There was no public school left in this particular area of Chicago. That's frightening.
So it also gets to, maybe proponents of the charter school movement don't feel that everybody should be going to school. I mean, maybe democracy doesn't mean to some people everybody gets to go to school. I mean, that's not the same. That's not democracy, and everybody getting to go to school are not obvious. They don't obviously necessarily go together. Well, anything else, Mark?
No, but thanks for providing this forum, and I think that these conversations, you know, definitely need to be had, and to whatever degree you're able to facilitate that with your show, it's a great forum for people to be able to exchange some ideas, begin having some conversation in some community space regarding, you know, these issues of public schools and how they should be operated.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, and call back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. That got you going, right?
Yeah, definitely.
What you saw in the American Indian Public Charter School, you had a reaction to the kids standing up.
Well,
there.
Yeah, because after 12 years of working with children, what I feel works the best is not me punishing them every time something goes wrong. It's me finding out what motivates them and how to use that in the classroom. So whether that's books or activities that make them come alive, mm-hmm. to the point where learning becomes, I want them to become intrinsically curious, to carry on lifelong learning, to be lifelong readers, the joy of discovery, all those things. Writing for expressing yourself and the joy that comes through that. The fact that there was no artwork or even technology included, I don't know. To me, that is, it's just not, it doesn't fit with who I am and what I've learned about children.
Now, some people, when they hear that kind of language, they feel like it's, you know, we talk about that you want children to be motivated to learn, lifelong learners, joy of learning. Some people think, oh, that's just being, you know, politically correct, or like that's, well, because they can't do it. You know what I mean? Like they see a class of 36 or 30 or 40 kids, and they think about, you know, lifelong learners and getting them motivated by the joy of learning. And I'm not saying I'm one of these people who thinks it's politically correct, because I think that's the way you do it. And when I think of my own situation, my administrator teaches me a lot about how not to be, because she sees that I don't respect her authority, and then in response she tries to hurt me enough that I will respect her authority, but she gives me no positive reason to respect her authority.
And that's, I think, a lot of what we just saw in that video at right. that charter school. It's exactly what we just saw.
And I guess it works if the whole system, you know, closes the vice on the individual.
Yeah, and then the end goal being the test scores, if that's the only end goal, sure, it might work for that, you know, but how is the student really feeling, like we said, about all these things, about themselves, about the world, about reading, about writing, about curiosity, about experimentation, like, those are not things that you can, you know, find out from just the test scores, so I don't know. It's just that model, yeah, I clearly do not need to apply to that school. I don't fit that model.
All right, great. Well, I'm not sorry we watched it, though. Are you sorry we watched it?
No, it's interesting. Okay. And I know of other, there's a other charter school chains that follow the same sort of, yeah. structure I know of them in LA.
And some parents, they want their kids treated like that.
As a parent, I've had these conversations with parents. I see why they embrace aspects of the charter school movement because, first of all, big schools are overwhelming, daunting, 3,000, you know, student campuses. Parents are, I don't even know if they found their place in the school or feel welcome in the schools a lot of the times. So automatically a charter school is smaller. The overall campus is smaller. The classroom sizes in most cases are smaller, but not always. And the discipline is much different. And I think parents see that and they welcome that. They want that. But again, in public school, we can't just kick people out all that easily. It's a different animal. Comparing apples and oranges.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that I caused you stress. You look like you're just beaten down by that whole having to think about that.
Well, yeah, because it, like I said, it goes against everything I feel that I've come to know in my years in the classroom. Uh-huh. It goes against everything I know about kids. So it's unfortunate.
So have you thought about trying to change the curriculum so that people would be able to give kids the things they want? I mean, you gave me this – you turned me on to Bluford books, which are cheap enough that I can buy it for the whole class, dollar each. And it's all about, like, these urban themes with kids, and the kids actually really like reading them.
Yeah, I talk about the Bluford series pretty much everywhere I work, everywhere I go. I just presented at the 4LA by LA conference last weekend, and same thing. I was sure to make sure everyone in the room knew about the Bluford series. www.townsendpress.com, a dollar a book, and they're by far the most incredible series I've come across for reluctant readers. Most reluctant readers really enjoy the whole series. So the question, do I think about doing what with curriculum?
Getting into a position where you are one of the writers of the curriculum for classes and one of the, I don't know who does that, but you know how people at the district hand down the curriculum to the teachers?
Yeah, I know. I don't know that I would be someone that would be selected. Let's put it that way. I don't know if I would be wanted on a team of rewriting curriculum, but... Sure, it's an idea for the future, sure.
Well, I promised you this would be an hour show, and so I know that you have a life.
I do.
So I'm going to go out, yeah?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm going to play either a guy named Rocco Davis from the rally or Tom Morello. Rocco Davis was talking about how we need to... He ultimately said we need to slaughter the rich. And then Tom Morello sings This Land Is Your Land. So which one would you like to hear?
This Land Is Your Land.
Figured. Okay. Let me see if I can cut to the point where he sings it.
So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to sing the last secret censored verse of this song, and you're going to listen with rapt attention. I'm going to ask you a question, and you're going to answer in full throat. And together, we're going to sing This Land Is Your Land as loud as anyone has ever sung it in a square in the middle of Los Angeles, loud enough so they can hear us at Capitol Square in Madison, Wisconsin. And then incredibly and indelibly and finally, everybody in this place, front to back, side to side, these guys over here and Mary Morello sitting down over there. Mom, could you stand up? This is America's alternative national anthem. Stand up, please. Thank you very much. Everybody in this whole place, I want to jump the fuck up. Are you with me, people? I need to know if you're with me. Let me know. All right. That was a complicated set of instructions, so I'm going to go through it again. I sing the verse. You listen. I ask the question, you answer. Together we sing loudly. And when the night watchman gives the word, we jump the fuck up. You got that, people? Here we go. In the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, near the relief office, I see my people. And some are grumbling, and all are wondering. if this land's still made for you and me. Tell them! And that is that we are going to stand with them, and not only are we going to fight for their rights, we're going to stand up for our rights here, in our state, in our homes, and in our community. Because the future of labor's rights in the United States of America is not going to be decided in the courts. It's not going to be decided in Congress. It's not going to be decided on talk radio, and as sure as shit is not going to be decided on Fox News. Working people's rights in this country is going to be decided on the streets of Wisconsin, on the streets of Indiana, on the streets of Ohio, on the streets of Florida, and on the streets of Los Angeles, California. Which leads to the first song in my program today. Brothers and sisters, this is a fighting song. This first song I'm going to play for you is a freedom song. Jam that I'm about to drop on your collective ass, Los Angeles, is a union song. We'll fight all the workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. The peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job, and she can't feed her family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes. Say, signatures smell rotten on the contracts and the deeds. Push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets. They fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas. Dig in, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers, our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. It's appropriate to cheer loudly now, people. Si nos queremos, juntos vamos a ganar. Si, y'all hit them where it hurts and bite the hand that feeds. You might get 1 to 3 on probation and a fine. Well, I know where I'm going to be. I'm going to be right on that front line. Don't Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez fought in their own time. For our brothers, our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Stop clapping. Back to the serious shit. Now dirty scabs will cross the line while others stand aside and look. But ain't nobody never got nothing that didn't raise their voice and push. like the steelwork in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Wisconsin, janitor in Mississippi, from the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flat, there's a thundercloud exploding, I'm free at last! Oh, hell, he's a sharp-ass, fought in their own time, like our brothers, our sisters, up and down that picket line, like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long, like the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Yeah. Fists up in solidarity. Fists up in solidarity. Fists up in solidarity. Fuck yeah. Pavarello. I got one more song to play. I'd like to play a song. I ain't done yet. I'm ready. I'm rocking the crowd here, people, in my hometown of Los Angeles, California. I was at home right now. My wife is about to give birth to our second baby boy, and any minute now. And I said, honey, I'll be back soon, but that child's gonna be a union man, so I gotta go represent. She said, you're the night watchman, go take care of your business, all right? I'm going to play a song by a great supporter of the working class, a great supporter of unions, and a great songwriter, a gentleman by the name of Woody Guthrie. And this is a song when I first learned it in the third grade, I didn't really realize the radical and revolutionary meaning of this song because they censored out all the verses that would explain it. It was kind of this happy little melody. So I'm going to restore those verses today for you here because Woody Guthrie knew, like you know, that history is not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. The wheel of history is in your hands. And it's what we do or fail to do during our time that will determine what our lives are like, our community, our country, and our future is going to be like. So thank you very much for having me here today. It's an honor to stand shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters in my hometown of Los Angeles. And here's a reminder we can tell the fat cats on Wall Street and those jackass governors across the Midwest. This land is our land. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. That's right. As I was walking, I saw Rocco Davis.
What's right is protecting working families. union families and all working families, because brothers and sisters, the folks that aren't in unions yet aren't our enemies. They're our friends. They're our allies. We need to teach them our message. They need to have what we have, and we got to stand up, and we got to fight to give them what we have, brothers and sisters. These corporate profiteers are stealing the future of our country. They're starting wars that we don't need to start. They're attacking countries that we've got no business attacking. You know, we've all watched on the news what's going on in Libya and what's going on in Egypt, and how proud I am of those working men and women in those countries for standing up for what's right and standing up for what's justice. Well, what we've got to tell these Republicans, actually we should start calling them corporate cans, because that's exactly what they are. They're owned by corporations. They're in the back pockets of corporations. And they don't give a good damn about working people and working families, do they? No, they don't. So we got to work to make sure that we stand strong in California. We got to make sure that we don't go backwards in California. That's right. And then we got to step up, and we got to help the rest of this country. Where are my brothers and sisters from the laborers? Let me see these orange shirts. I thank every one of you for coming out here today and for standing up and for marching, because what we're talking about is union power. We're talking about people power. That's right. We're talking about the future of this country. Can you feel the power that you generated today with this march? Can you feel the power, brothers and sisters, with the power that you generated with this march today? I can tell you right now, I'm not going to stand by and let anybody take away my collective bargaining rights. Are you? No. Hell no, you're not going to. Are you going to let them take away your pension? No. We didn't mess those pensions up. The Wall Street bankers messed those pensions up, didn't they? They're like pigs at a trough. That's what they are. They're pigs eating at a trough. And there is nothing that's enough for them. Greed knows no bound for these corporate pigs. I say, brothers and sisters, we get strong, we get militant, we get angry, we get active, we take back our country. We take back our country. And let me tell you what, when we take back our country, you know what you do with pigs? You take them to the slaughterhouse and you slaughter them, damn it! So today is the beginning. Today is not the end. You need to stay active. You need to work with your local unions when they need you. You need to stand up for what's right, what's going on in this country. Brothers and sisters, I am honored to be in front of you here today. God bless you all. Si se puede! Si se puede!
Mark Davis, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my God, let's try.